Good morning. I hope you're all well today. It's good to be back up here in the pulpit on a Sunday morning. It's always a privilege to take an opportunity to proclaim the Word of God. And so that's what we want to do this morning. We've taken a look already at the passage in the book of Exodus that Evan read for us. And I'd like to go back to that passage. This is the incident of Moses at the burning bush. This is not a photograph you see on the screen behind us. I don't know exactly what it looks like, but this is one artist's depiction of what he imagined it to be like with Moses there at the burning bush. God appeared to Moses and called upon him to travel down to Egypt to free the children of Israel from bondage there among the Egyptians. And I think the books of Genesis and Exodus are, to me, are some of the most interesting books of the Bible. They're very interesting people with very interesting and dramatic stories about their lives and their interactions among each other and with God. And I really enjoy reading about Moses and the children of Israel. And this is like one of my favorite parts of the Bible here. There's quite an extensive description in the book of Exodus here of Moses meeting God at the burning bush. The Israelites had been in Egypt for quite some time, for generations, and they had been there surrounded by the pagan Egyptian religion and the pagan Egyptian worship. And it's a little unclear to me exactly what they knew about the true and living God, the God of their fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. When we see them out into the wilderness after they're released from slavery, we see that they very quickly descended into idolatry, and they were, even throughout their whole history, they were constantly being drawn away from the true and living God to worship of idols. So it's a little unclear to me exactly what they understood about who God was. Moses says here, in Exodus chapter 3, and we were reading from verse 13, Moses said to God, "Behold, I'm going to the sons of Israel, and I should say to them, 'The God of your fathers has sent me to you.' Now they may say to me, 'What is his name?' There were lots of gods as far as they were concerned, as far as the Egyptians were concerned, and all of the gods had their own names. And Moses says, they're going to ask me, I'm going to tell them God has sent me, and they're going to say, "Well, which God? What's the name of this God that sent you?" I hear that kind of question even today. I've found that if you discuss God with an atheist, one of the common rejoinders that the atheist will come back with is, you say you believe in God, and the atheist likes to say, "Well, which God do you believe in?" And sometimes with a chuckle, as if to say, "Well, you know, there have always been all of these gods that of mythology. People believe in all kinds of things, and one God is as good as another." And of course, the atheist says that none of them are good really for anything, because they're all mythical. Notice how God tells Moses to identify him. Moses said to God, "Behold, I'm going to the sons of Israel, and I should say to them, 'The God of your fathers has sent me to you.' Now they may say to me, 'What is his name?' What shall I say to them?" And God said to Moses, "I am who I am." And he said, "Thus you shall say to the sons of Israel, 'I am has sent me to you.'" Seems like maybe a bit of a strange way to identify himself. What's the name of your God? Moses, is God that has sent you. And he identifies himself by the name I Am. I Am sent me to you, he says. And I think God says something very important and profound when he identifies himself as I Am. He says a couple of things when he identifies himself as I Am. And I think we need to think about this a bit. He's saying, I am the God that exists. The Egyptians have all of their gods of Osiris and Thoth and others, Isis, the goddess, and they didn't exist. They existed only in the minds of people that imagined them. But the God that Moses served and the God that sent Moses is the God that does exist. I think when God identifies himself as I Am, one thing he's saying, I am the God that exists. I exist. Who sent you, Moses? The existing one. I ponder sometimes God and his nature, and I'm completely baffled. I don't understand God in many ways. His eternal power and might, his eternal presence, his timelessness, to try to comprehend his eternal and powerful and holy attributes, it staggers my imagination. I see some of the things the scriptures say about God, and I can sort of nod my head in acknowledgement. Yes, God is a God of perfect love. Yes, I can see him saying that about himself. God is the God of unlimited power. I can see that. And the God is the God who exists. Not because he was created, not because he had a beginning, but he exists just because he does. This is his nature. Why does God exist? Because it is his nature to exist. And the thought, another thing that the atheist likes to say, we say, the world, the universe, you can see God in the creation. And you can see that the universe has not always been here. And even those who believe in a kind of godless science will say that. And one thing about the Big Bang theory of the origin of the universe is that there was the bang, and until the bang, there was no universe. And there was a time before the universe existed. Even according to the godless theories of origins. And so the universe has not always existed. And we think about before the universe originated and then after the universe originated. And even those terms suggest something about the nature of the universe and the nature of God. The concept of before and after is indicative of a concept of time and the passage of time. Because without time, there is no before and there is no after. And we think about God, and we think about that God is self-existent, and we think about that God exists not because he was created, not because there was a time when there was no God and then suddenly he was here. There was no before and after with God. Notice he doesn't speak of himself in the past tense. He doesn't say, I used to exist, and I exist now, and I always will. He doesn't use that kind of time terminology. But he says, I am one eternal present for God. He exists because he does. and there was no before, and there was no after. And I contemplate God's eternal nature, which I believe he's speaking of here. And I'll tell you, I can say it, and I can say God is eternal, and he has no beginning, and he has no end. But I don't believe that I can really fully comprehend all of the implications of that and what it really means to me and to us in this world. But I believe that it is true. There are people, there are philosophers and people who spend their days contemplating these things and studying them and making arguments about them. And I find some of those arguments interesting, and I read some of them sometimes, and I read about what men say about the eternal nature and existence of God. And after it's done, I say, well, that was interesting, but I still don't feel like I have any more understanding than I did before. So I just have to say, God is I am. He is the one who exists. And he always has, and he always will. And when I say that, even I'm thinking of time and the passage of time, and I'm not sure that that means anything to God in his existence. This is one thing that God is saying when he says, when he identifies himself as I am. He is real. He is the God who exists, and he is saying that he is eternal, that the passage of time really means very little to God. Peter said in 2 Peter in chapter 3, he's talking about God's promises, and I hadn't planned on reading that, but I think maybe I will. 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 8. He's been talking about the promises of God and his fulfillment of them. And he says in 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 8, Peter says, "But do not let this one fact escape your notice, beloved, that with the Lord one day is 1,000 years, and 1,000 years as one day." I don't think he's trying to give us some kind of a mathematical formula here that we can use to calculate calendar computations. A day is 1,000 years, set up some kind of an equation. 1,000 years is equal to one day. One day is equal to 1,000 years. I think that kind of misses the point. I've heard people look at they look at the book of Genesis and the 6 days of creation, and they say, well, God created in 6 days, but you know, a day is 1,000 years with God, so that first day was really 1,000 years, and I think they've just missed the point. I don't think that's what he's saying, Peter's saying, when he says a day with God is 1,000 years and 1,000 years is a day. I think he's saying that God doesn't experience time the way we experience time and the way we measure time. And time means very little to God. The book of John, Jesus has some interesting things to say in using that expression, I am. Starting in John chapter 6 and going for several chapters, actually, Jesus periodically makes an I am statement. I'm looking at John chapter 6, verse 35. John chapter 6, verse 35. Jesus said to them, "I am the bread of life. He who comes to me shall not hunger, and he who believes in me shall never thirst." I am, he says, I am the bread of life. And throughout these several chapters, there are actually 7 different statements that he makes beginning with I am. And I'd kind of like to take a sidebar here and study with you in some detail Jesus' 7 I am statements. And we could easily make a whole lesson out of each one of them individually, and we would be here for longer than I intend to speak this morning. But that would, if you're looking, those of you who speak and preach occasionally, if you're looking for a good sermon series, you might try the seven I am statements of Jesus, and you can get a good and valuable lesson out of each one of them. But in John chapter 6, Jesus says in verse 35, he says, I am the bread of life. He who comes to me shall not hunger, and he who believes in me shall never thirst. And he's living in a world where bread was the staple of their diet. They raised grain, and they ground it, and they made bread from it. Even in our own language, have you noticed that the word that means ground grain, meal, is the word that we use to describe a dining event? We have a meal, we have the service this morning, and we will end and we'll say amen, and then we'll go have our noonday meal. Bread. Do you think about that meal is the same as ground, the word for ground grain? They lived in a society where this was really a staple of their diet, and throughout the New Testament especially, you'll see references to eating bread. And that's just sort of their idiom for talking about, I'm going to have a meal. I'm going to have something to eat. It's eat bread, because so often that's what it was. Bread is what sustained them. Bread was their primary food, and it's what sustained them. It's what gave them their life and enabled them to maintain their life. And Jesus says, I am the bread of life. He refers to the manna that God brought down from heaven during the time of the wandering, bread from heaven. That's what Jesus is. He is the bread of life. Through him, we have life. We have our lives by him and by his creation. John chapter 8, verse 12. Again, therefore, Jesus spoke to them, saying, I am the light of the world. And he who follows me shall not walk in darkness, but shall have the light of life. Darkness and light are used as metaphors throughout the scripture to help us to understand our walk before God. Walking in light is walking by faith in Jesus, and walking in darkness is walking living without faith in Jesus. And so we see light contrasted with darkness. And Jesus says, I am the light. Darkness is the bad. Darkness is the evil. Darkness is what takes us away from God. Eternal punishment is referred to as outer darkness. But with God is eternal light and eternal day. And Jesus says, I am the light of the world. I'm the bread of life that brings you your life. And I'm the light of the world that gives you and brings you that goodness and holiness that God is and that God is about. Chapter 10, verse 7, Jesus therefore said to them again, truly, truly, I say to you, I am the door of the sheep. All who come before me are thieves and robbers, but the sheep did not hear them. I am the door. If anyone enters through me, he shall be saved and shall go in and out and find pasture. Jesus is described as the shepherd. He describes himself here as the door, a sheepfold, an enclosure. Some translations use the word gate instead of door, but imagine some kind of an enclosure, a corral, something with a fence or a wall around it, and there's a gate. And that's where the sheep can go, where they will be protected and they will be safe from the wild animals that might prey on them. Go into the sheepfold and they will be safe there. And there's a door, a gate that opens, and through that gate you can enter into the safety of the fold. And Jesus says, I am that door, I am that gate, and through that gate you can enter into the safety of forgiveness of your sins. You'll hear people say that doesn't matter what you believe about God, believe as you wish. We're all going to the same place. We're just taking different routes, different paths. That is not what Jesus taught. Jesus taught that there's one door, there's one gate into the sheepfold, and he is it. And through Jesus, safety is found from the wiles of Satan and from the death that comes from sin. Jesus says, I am the door. I am the gate for the sheep. Chapter 10, verse 11, just a couple of verses down, he says, I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. You know, the bad shepherd, I suppose if there's a good shepherd, maybe there's also a bad shepherd. The bad shepherd is out for himself. The bad shepherd, when the lion comes or the wolf comes, the bad shepherd flees to protect himself and forget the sheep. But the good shepherd is all about the sheep and protecting the sheep and serving the sheep. And Jesus says, I'm the good shepherd. And when the wolf comes, the good shepherd will stand between the wolf and the sheep, even if it means losing his own life, which is precisely what Jesus did in standing between us and Satan and going to the cross so that we can receive forgiveness of our sins. He was serving there as the good shepherd who is so self-sacrificial. When I ponder, you know, I ponder the nature of God and his eternal power and might, and I just really can't comprehend it. And then I ponder the fact that he came and became one of us, God the Son, and then sacrificed himself for our sake. That I really have trouble wrapping my mind around. What a great and wonderful and glorious God we have that would do that for us, that he would sacrifice himself for us. Jesus says, I am the good shepherd who gives his life for the sheep. Chapter 11, verse 25, I am the resurrection and the life. Verse 25, I'll find it here in a second. And Jesus said to her, I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me shall live even if he dies. I am the resurrection and the life. We human beings have one great problem that we all share, and that's the problem of death. We see it even in the animals, this instinct for self-preservation. And it is certainly in the hearts of men, we think of death. We don't want to think of death, actually. We prefer not to think of death. We prefer not to think of the death of our loved ones who we have lost, if we can help it. And we prefer not to think of our own death. This is the problem, the one central problem to all of mankind, and that is the problem of death that comes from sin. Temptation brings forth sin, and sin brings forth death. That's just the way it is. That's the nature of sin, and that's the nature of death. And Jesus says, I am the resurrection and the life. This is how he characterizes himself. He is the resurrection. You believe in Jesus? You believe that you will die? There's a problem, but there is a solution to that problem. And it's what Jesus came to do for us. That good shepherd came to die for us, the sheep. And he did so, dying and then raising himself as the firstborn of the resurrection. Jesus says, I am the resurrection. And walking by faith in him gives us the promise, and we know it's true. And we know he can and will do it because we've seen him do it in the resurrection that he experienced. Jesus says, I am the resurrection and the life. And those who believe in Jesus and who walk by faith in him do not have to fear death, because death is temporary. Death is momentary. And there is life yet to come after that death. And so I still have a kind of, I tell myself, natural fear of death. It's not something that I look forward to. It's not something I'm eager for. In fact, it's not a good thing. It's the result of sin, ultimately. Jesus came to triumph over it. So I have a bit of fear of death, but you know, I really don't need to, because it's just going to be for a little while. I'm not sure. That's something else. I'm not sure I really can understand what it's all going to be like, but I know that I have resurrection and I have life promised by the Lord if I'll walk by faith in him. Jesus says, I am the resurrection and the life. John chapter 14, verse 6. Jesus said to him, I am the way. I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father but through me. Another statement here that tells us not only who he is, but it tells us something about the reality of our own lives. Like, there's only one door in the sheepfold. There is only one truth. And Jesus says, I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father but through me. And as we've observed, the world around us doesn't like this thought. You're a religious bigot if you believe it's only through Jesus that you can receive salvation. That's what the world would tell us. Well, and we don't want to be called ugly names, and we don't want to hear people thinking those kinds of things about us. I don't want people to call me a bigot. But you know, if I'm going to believe in the Lord, I'm going to believe in Jesus of Nazareth. There is an essential truth here. There is a reality here that I need not shy away from. And if others don't believe it, that is regrettable for them. But I don't have to go down that road with them. And I can stand with confidence against that scoffer and that skeptic who may laugh at me, but I can stand with confidence and say that it is only through Jesus of Nazareth that we have entrance into the presence of the Father. And men may say, you can get there to God through this means and through that means and through this prophet and through that doctrine. But Jesus says it is only through him that one can come to the Father. I am the way and the truth and the life. That's number six. Number seven of Jesus's seven I am statements. John chapter 15, verse 1. I am the true vine, and my Father is the vine dresser. Every branch in me that does not bear fruit, he takes away, and every branch that bears fruit, he prunes it, that it may bear more fruit. I am the true vine. After we have a storm, I go out into my yard, and there are all these branches lying around that have fallen down out of the trees. And the branch is lying there on the ground, and it doesn't have a trunk anymore that it's attached to. And it's going to lie there, and it's going to die, and I'll come back the next day and the leaves will be drying up, and a couple days after that, they'll be completely dry and brittle and that branch will be dead. The branch needs a trunk to be attached to be a living and useful branch. And we need a branch. We as branches need a trunk to be attached to. Or Jesus is using an expression here from a world where they grew a lot of grapes. He's using the expression of a vine. But the vine is like the trunk of the tree. There's the vine, and attached to the vine are the branches, and out on the ends of the branches are the grapes. And we are the branches, but Jesus is the vine. He's that trunk. And without him, we will have no life. And we'll be like that limb that falls out of your tree. We'll shrivel up and we will die without Jesus in our lives. He says, I am the true vine. These are the seven I am statements of Jesus. I am the bread of life. I am the light of the world. I am the door for the sheep. I am the good shepherd. I am the resurrection and the life. I am the way, the truth, and the life. I am the vine. There's one more statement. I think there's actually an eighth I am statement. It is one overarching statement that covers all of these. And John chapter 8, verse 58. Jesus has said in verse 56, he's talking to the people there in his day, and he says, your father Abraham, and the people he's talking to are Jews, descendants of Abraham, children of Israel, and he says, your father Abraham rejoiced to see my day. And he saw it and was glad. That's in verse 56. And the Jews therefore said to him, you're not yet 50 years old, and have you seen Abraham? At this time, Abraham was already 2,000 years in the past, approximately. And here's this man standing before them that says, Abraham saw my day. And they just know this guy's got to be crazy. You're not even 50 years old yet, and you've seen Abraham. Jesus says in verse 58, he says this, truly, truly, I say to you, before Abraham was born, I am. It's a little bit awkward in English grammar. But he's not saying before Abraham was born, I was born. He doesn't speak of himself in the past tense here. In fact, he uses exactly that same statement that the Father used when he was meeting Moses at the bush. Who is it that sent you, Moses? The people are going to ask. Tell them, I am sent you. And I will hear people say sometimes about the Bible, Jesus never claimed to be divine. And if you're looking for a statement in the Bible where Jesus says, I am divine, and those words, it's true, you're not going to find it in exactly those words. But I believe you find exactly that idea right here when Jesus says, before Abraham was born, I am. And those Jews that he was talking to understood what he was saying when he said that. He was not just saying, I'm really, really old. What he was saying was, essentially, I am God. I am divine. Because he describes himself in the same attributes that God used to describe himself when he met Moses at the burning bush. And those people understood that, and you can tell they understood it from the next verse, verse 59. Therefore, they picked up stones to throw at him. But Jesus hid himself and went out to the temple. Blasphemy was punishable by death, by stoning. And they understood Jesus to be claiming to be God here, and they were going to stone him to death for blasphemy. It was not his time yet. They were not successful in stoning him on this occasion. They had their time and their moment to crucify him on the cross. But Jesus was claiming to be God. Not only to be God, the God that exists, but the God who is eternal. Before Abraham was, I am. Today is the last Sunday of 2019. This is the last Sunday morning sermon of this year. Has it been a long year? Have you accomplished what you meant to accomplish in this year? Some of you may remember that on the last Sunday of 2018, I was up here on that day presenting a lesson. Today's sermon is the world's longest sermon. It's about a year long, and it started last year. Some of you are here. I know many of you are not, but I'm going to remind you of some of the things we talked about last year. on the last Sunday of 2018. At the end of the year, it's a time when we're thinking about the passage of time. The calendar is changing. We're going on to the next year, and we're thinking about not only the passage of time, but we're thinking about our own lives and our own growing old. You may recall, if you were here last year, this gentleman, his name is Mba Goto. He's from Indonesia. He's no longer living. He died in April of 2017. He claimed to be 146 years old at the time of his death. In fact, he had a government-issued ID card from the government of Indonesia that said as much, that he was 146 years old. I don't know. There are not many people that really believe that he was that old. People who study aging say that there's no way that this man was 146 years old. By modern-day standards of documentation, it cannot be proved. And so if you're looking for the world's oldest person, it was not this guy because, frankly, nobody really believes it, except maybe some of his own family and some in the small village in Indonesia where he lived. But maybe he was. Who knows? I certainly don't know myself. But he certainly lived to be quite an old man. By modern day standards of documentation, this is the oldest person in the modern day who has ever lived. And this is Jean Calment of France, who died in 1997 at the age of 122. Her age is pretty much indisputable. When I mentioned her in the sermon last year, someone, I don't remember now who it was, but somebody came to me afterwards and said they just read a news article about her, and there's some question as to whether she was really the person she claimed to be and whether she was really this old. I read that article and some things that were said about her. Perhaps it was a hoax. Perhaps she was really her daughter and not herself, and she wasn't really 122 when she died. I've read some of those claims. I find them to be of very little merit. They are more, I find them harder to believe than to believe that she was actually 122 years old. That's my opinion. You can think whatever you'd like about Jean Calment and whether she was 122, but by modern day accounting, she is generally regarded as the oldest person who ever lived, and she is now gone. And you may remember this little Japanese lady, Kane Tanaka. And this time last year, she was the world's oldest person as far as anybody knew at that time, again, according to modern day standards of documentation. The world's oldest person. Would you like to be the world's oldest person? I understand that in Japanese culture, they are very attuned to the notion of respecting your elders. Well, I guess she didn't have anybody left to respect, because there's nobody older than Kane Tanaka at that time last year. I did a little looking around yesterday, and you may be interested to know that as of yesterday, Kane Tanaka is still living. And if she makes it till this Thursday, her birthday is January the 2nd, and if she makes it to this Thursday, she'll be 117 years old. Last year, we read from the book of Genesis, chapter 5, and I think I will not do that since we just did it a year ago. I think I'll not do that today. But in Genesis chapter 5, we find the genealogy of starting with Adam and going up to Abraham. And we find there was this person who lived and had lived to an old age and had sons and daughters, and then there was the next person and the next person and the next person. And we read through all of these. Let me read the first couple here in Genesis chapter 5, verse 3. When Adam had lived 130 years, he became the father of a son of his own likeness, according to his image, and named him Seth. And then the days of Adam, after he became the father of Seth, were 800 years, and he had other sons and daughters. So all the days that Adam lived were 930 years, and he died. And Seth lived 105 years and became the father of Enosh. Then Seth lived 807 years, and after he became the father of Enosh, he had other sons and daughters, and so all the days of Seth were 912 years, and he died. And so it goes from generation to generation to generation. And we observe that there are two things that all of these people in this genealogy have in common. There are two things. One, they live to extraordinarily old ages. 700, 800, 900 years. By the way, do you remember the 500-year-old clam? People look at these ages in the genealogy, and here's a man who lived to be 930 years old, and they say, well, that's just not possible. It must be a myth. I don't know why we would say it's not possible. And this is the clam. You remember the clam from last year, some of you, that was dredged up off the bottom of the North Atlantic. And you can measure the life, if you're up on your clam lore, you can measure the life of a clam by counting the striations in the shell, like the growth rings in a tree. And this clam has been confirmed to be 507 at the time of its unfortunate death when somebody dredged it up off the floor of the ocean. 507 years. Why can a clam live to be 507 years old and a man or a woman at the age of 117 is remarkably old that we think surely she can't live another year? Science doesn't give us any reason why we age at the rate we do. I don't know of any reason to believe it's not possible for a man to live 930 years in ancient times under other conditions. By the power of God, these people all had two things in common. They lived to remarkably old ages, and they all died. I don't know if I'm going to live to be a remarkably old age or not, and I don't know if you're going to live to be a remarkably old age or not, but you know, I don't think it really matters. Because it's going to be with us like it was with Adam and like it was with Seth and all of the others in this genealogy. We may not get the old age, but we will get the death. And we think about these things as the calendar turns and we go from one year to the next. We think about our own death. There's a reason, so this sermon has been like about a year long, and I'm glad to hear the news, by the way, that Dempsey will be coming to join us, and I don't know how long Dempsey preaches. I'm thinking not a year at a time, probably, but you know, preachers all seem to have this problem, that when you get up into the pulpit, you look at the clock and you think, oh, well, I've got plenty of time. And you've got a five-point sermon, and you're going, and you're reading your scriptures, and you're making your points, and then you look at the clock again, and you realize it's now been about 45 minutes, and you're only about halfway through point number two. It seemed like you've got so much time at the beginning, and somehow it just gets away from you, and the next thing you know, it's gone. I asked you some questions last year, and I told you that if I had the opportunity this year, I would ask you about those questions again. And so that's what I'm going to do. I challenged you last year to look forward into 2019 and think about how you wanted to use that year in your life. What did you want to see at the end of 2019 as you look back over the year? What did you want to be able to see in your life? Have you achieved the things that you said you wanted to see in your life? And I'm thinking about your service to the Lord. Did you want to see a year of living for yourself and the world? Or do you want to see a year of living for God? Did you get started on that January the 1st? And did you devote a full year of devoted service to the Lord? Or did you do like the preachers do sometimes and start off at the year and think, oh, I've got plenty of time. And, you know, I can get started on that tomorrow. And then tomorrow, it's next week is going to be here soon, and that'll be soon enough. And the next thing you know, it's the end of December. And I'm hoping that if you decided to rededicate your life to God's service, I'm hoping that you did that and you used that full year. Look back on it now in hindsight and ask yourself if you did. Did you spend a year living your life to the glory of God? God created us for His glory. And the book of Isaiah, chapter 43, almost in passing, the prophet says that God created us for His glory. Did you spend a year fulfilling your purpose of glorifying God? Or was that also something that you kind of put off a day or a week or 6 months? And you only think about it again when the New Year's Eve sermon rolls around. Well, I don't know whether I'll be up here again on the first Sunday of next year, the last Sunday of next year. So I'm not going to make any promises about that. This is the end of this year-long sermon. But I want to leave you with these thoughts. Life is short. You may live to be 117 or 122 or 146. I don't know. But life will be short. Maybe you'll live to be 930, like Adam. I doubt it. But I'm thinking when Adam got to the end of his life, he thought, the time passed quickly. Life is short, and then you'll be like Adam and Seth, and you will die, and then you will go on. Will you go through that gate of Jesus that he promises to us that he is? Let me challenge you again for the coming year. Think back over this past year and think about what has happened in your life and maybe changes that you have made. I'm thinking about changes that have happened. A lot of changes have happened over the past year. Changes have taken place here in the church. Sid was with us, and he was our full-time preacher this time last year. And Sid is not with us now. He's still around, of course, but he is not with us here as our full-time preacher. And change is taking place there. Other changes have taken place. Some of us have lost loved ones that were alive and with us last year, and they are not now. I know people who this time last year, as far as I knew, were strong and faithful servants of the Lord. And during the past year, they have abandoned the Lord. And it's very distressing to me, some of that I have seen. But there are people that were Christians last year and faithful to God that are not now. Think about your coming year. Maybe you'll have a full year and maybe you won't. I don't know. But I challenge you to don't wait. Get started now in serving God. Make it your way of life to walk by faith in Jesus, to serve God. Some things that you can do. I made a list here of some things you can do. You can read the Bible every day. Do you do that? I try to do that. I confess some days I miss. But I try to read the Bible every day. And I've got a list that I follow of what passages to read. And if you don't have such a list and would like one, you know, you can find lots of them on the internet if you use the internet. But if you'd like one, I can give you one. Let me know and I'll be glad to see that you get such a reading list to sort of help you pace yourself throughout the year. If you'd like to, I do that so I can read the whole Bible in a year. I've already finished Revelation a couple of days ago, and I get started in Revelation and I find it so interesting I just hate to quit, and so I just went ahead and finished off the whole thing. And on Wednesday I'll get started back in the book of Genesis and I'll read through the Bible again next year. That is my plan anyway, and I may miss some days occasionally. But you can read the Bible and read the Bible every day. And if you can do that, you can easily read the whole Bible in a year, even less than that, if you read a little bit faster than I do. You can host a Bible study in your home. I know some of you already do that. And you invite your friends and you invite your Christian friends to come to your home to study the Bible together. And you invite your neighbors and people who you know who are not Christians who are interested in Bible study. And you can have a Bible study in your home this year. Don't wait till the end of November to get started on that. In fact, you don't even need to wait till January the 1st and Wednesday of this week. You can go ahead and get started on that. You can host a Bible study in your home. Or if you're not up to doing that, then you can attend a Bible study in someone else's home. And you can do that on a regular basis and spend your year in Bible study and learning more about God and dedicating your life to Him. Are you going to be here every time the church meets throughout the coming year? You can be here every time the door is open in the coming year and serve God. Now, we understand that sometimes we are sick and we, due to illness, we're not able to be here, or maybe we're traveling, we're out of town, and we're not able to be here. And I stand up here and say, try to be here every service. And those of you who know me know that I spend a lot of time out of town with my job, and I'm not generally here on Wednesday nights. But you know, I will say this, that if I'm not here on Wednesday night, I'm generally worshiping with the Brentwood Church in Brentwood, Tennessee, just south of Nashville. And I find that's very valuable to me when the church doors are open to be there and associate with brothers and sisters in Christ. I spend a lot of time in my life from day to day associating with people who are not Christians and who have no interest in the gospel. And it is very helpful and encouraging to me just to be there and just to be with other Christians and just to associate with them. And I may not even know what the lesson's going to be about, but I know that I can come. And even if I don't get anything out of the lesson, people will say, well, you know, the lessons are boring. Brian's going to preach again, and he's going to do another one of those clam sermons, and I'm just not going to get anything out of it. I understand that. As a person who preaches occasionally, I'm very attuned to the fact that I want to offer you something that will be very beneficial to you while you are here and listening. But I know maybe sometimes it's just not all that good. But you know, if you're coming to the services for just what you can get out of it, I think you've missed the point. Come to the services because of what you can give. It's very encouraging to me to see you all here this morning. And I appreciate my opportunity to associate with you today and to be with you and to talk with you and to enjoy fellowship with my Christian brothers and sisters. You can do that for other people, even if it's another clam sermon that you don't get anything out of. So that's something that you can do in the coming year. Don't wait until this time next December. You can start that tonight at 5:30 p.m. I hope you will be able to be here with us. So that's the end of my sermons for 2019. I encourage you to take the words of Jesus to heart. Listen to who He is. Listen to who God is. And respect God as the eternal, self-existent, non-ending, always has, always will be Creator who loves us so much that He gave His Son to come and die for us. A concept that I can hardly even comprehend. But He gave His Son to come and die for us so that He is the resurrection, and we can experience that resurrection too. If you would like to renew your life in Christ, if we can help you do that, we would be glad to help you, to pray with you, or to baptize you into Christ even today if you are not yet a Christian. We encourage you to come forward as we stand and sing the invitation song.